Hello and welcome to the award-winning Canine Hooper's World podcast. Everyone's invited. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of season 4 of Canine Hooper's World podcast. Now, I believe this is his third time coming on the pod. So this is like the Holy Trinity now. Andy. Hello, how are you?
Hi, Carrie. Well, that's quite an introduction, isn't it? We just love chatting together, don't we? And there's always lots to talk about, so.
Well, I feel like we've covered, obviously, the Pet Remedy stuff, because you and me both are, you work with Pet Remedy and I'm working alongside as well, and it's a great product and we love it. We discussed cake last time, and if you don't know what cake is, and unfortunately, it's not the stuff with sugar and yumminess, but it is just as good and equally as important. Go and check out the previous episode I did in season 3 with Andrew Howell. But Andy, today we were going to kind of discuss a little bit about just, I think, perceptions in dog world, behaviour. Social media is being a bit of a devil at the moment in ways. And now there's this whole Threads thing. Are you on Threads yet?
No.
I am. Well, I say I am. Dodges. And cool. I think we've done 3 threads and I don't understand it. I didn't really get on with Twitter either, though. And it just seems like a different type of Twitter. I don't understand.
No, and I'm still getting my head around Facebook, to be honest. So I'll just deal with that. My husband does all that. As you know, he's a TikTok queen. If only he could, you know, monetize his videos, I could just retire, which would be great. But yeah, he does Instagram, he does TikTok, he does all that kind of stuff. I don't think he does Twitter actually, but yeah, Facebook's enough for me, for sure.
Yeah, I understand that, but I just think that now we're kind of, as trainers, we're sort of expected to do all these different social media things because there is so much. First row of the episode, we're not even a minute in. Amazing. Shit information
there is, and it's hard, isn't it, because you have to feel for the general public, right? There's so much information out there now about dogs, and a lot of it's really contradictory for them. You mentioned Pet Remedy earlier. We're looking at doing a bit of a campaign this month, as in July and August, and trying to get the general public to see more of the more up-to-date information around training and behavior and welfare, because they're kind of bombarded with a lot of the crap, as you say, a lot of the kind of rubbishy stuff. And so it is really hard. And I think, especially here in the UK, because we've got one dog trainer, of course, who's developed a huge following through his stuff on TikTok. And I think this is just a reflection on so many different things. The main one, of course, is that we work within an unregulated industry. I think this is just, a lot of it comes back to that. So anybody can call themselves anything. And I think it's easy to kind of direct our venom towards these people, but they can, and they do. And we have, in the UK, we have the Animal Welfare Act, which should be, because of some lines, and I think it's section 4 that talks about unnecessary suffering, which we know that using heavy aversives like prong collars and shock collars and that kind of thing, that would come under that. But that never gets enforced enough. So we're just a bit stuck, really. And if you can get a big enough platform, you can put stuff out. But this feeds into, and this is something we can unpack today, I think, what we're all kind of indoctrinated in. And this is something I talk about with the talks I give and that kind of thing, because perception is everything. How you perceive a situation, the behavior of another, even how you perceive yourself, will very much kind of go on to dictate how you respond and what you do. And we have and I think we have to, on the positive side of the fence of training, have to take some responsibility here a little bit, because I feel the general public, the one thing they have been convinced of in the last 30, 40 years since the explosion of dog training as a thing, the most important thing is to somehow get their dog to be compliant. You know, the most important thing is a well-trained, obedient dog. That's what the general public really think. And that kind of message has come from both sides of the fence. So they're stuck in that. And that does fit what we're all indoctrinated in, which is the good bad continuum, as we call it.
Yep.
That is that we put behavior somehow on a sliding scale of good through to neutral through to bad, and that because we're indoctrinated into that, we don't even question it. You know, our society is based on it, school, mm-hmm. all this kind of stuff. And underpinning that is the notion of rewarding good, right? Or punishing bad, or on our side of the fence, ignoring bad. And it sounds right, doesn't it? Anybody listening will think, well, of course we want more of the good. We want less of the bad. Until we ask a couple of fundamental questions, and this is where we start to unravel some stuff, and we can start to unpack this a little bit, carry on, especially when we start thinking about those trainers who advocate for harsh methods,
mm-hmm.
And reckon that it is about choice, and reckon we can unpack that. So the couple of questions are these. The first one is the most fundamental one. Who's deciding what's good or bad?
Yep.
It's a really important question. I can decide that the behavior of another is intrinsically bad, but that would be based on my narrative. Now, I can talk in a couple of ways here. I want to share a couple of things with you. I'll come back to that in a second. But the second thing is, how arbitrary and prescriptive do those judgments become?
Mm-hmm.
We could have an understanding about somebody's challenging situation, but despite that, we are still expecting this behavior regardless. So it's very arbitrary.
But just to jump in quickly, I feel in a way that is just becoming a reflection of society and what we see, because there is so much, to be honest, anger and hate in places right now. And there is so much kind of with people deciding, as you say, what is right, what is wrong, but also what is aversive, what isn't. And I think that one of the problems we're getting is that with the way social media is and people get big followings and all the rest of it, it almost feels like someone being an influencer and having however many thousand, 100,000, million followers is therefore more of an expert and more qualified than someone that has literally studied and is a specialist in the same subject.
Yeah, that's
that's a really bizarre way for it to have become, isn't it? Because before, you know, in my little brain, the way my brain sort of worked with things is, I am a dog trainer because I train dogs. And people that have a behavior degree are behaviorists because they have a degree in behavior. And yes, there is a big gray area where we kind of mix over, and some training stuff is behavior and some behavior stuff needs training. But we still need to kind of understand, whereas it feels now these influencers have come in and just gone, we're going to change all of it. And you're like, but how do you know? Well, because we do this and it works. But at what cost?
At what cost? And this is the key. I think this is why that within our community specifically, we potentially have the rise through social media of these people who have a perception of dog training and behavior,
mm-hmm.
Which is fitting a narrative for the general public. This is what I was kind of alluding to about the good bad continuum, because we're so heavily indoctrinated into it, we don't question it. We think, well, yeah, and that's why people will perceive their dog, the dog that they love and have cuddles with, when they're behaving in a certain way, oh, that dog's being naughty, being bad, whatever it is. And this is the problem with the dominant model, of course, which is why it's quite pervasive still, because it kind of fits this notion that, oh yeah, that we're going to judge the behavior as being dominant. And the answer is for us dog to make sure the dog knows that we're boss, which just can give all sorts of a kind of a blank check to be quite horrible. But it's important that we unpack this, because I think when this is what we have to recognize, the general public, they've got an industry that's unregulated. They're already in the mindset of thinking their dog's behavior is somehow bad.
Mm-hmm.
And there is these influencers, you say, who use aversive methods, quite heavy aversive methods, actually. They're providing a prescription for that. I'll show you. And this is the difference between task and care that I talk about a lot, because when you're in a very task orientated transactional approach, it is just how do you do task. I think aversives, especially shock collars and the like, are a great example of task at all costs. We will get the dog. So the task being stop the dog pullings, get the dog to come back, stop the dog barking, whatever the task might be. We have to be very mindful on our side of the fence that we don't fall into a task at all costs. You know, I'm just going to keep ramping up the reinforcer. I'm going to change my reinforcement schedules. I'm going to do whatever I need to do because I am going to get that behavior regardless. Mm-hmm. What you and I believe passionately about is more of a care-oriented approach. And all that means really is that we take the time to get feedback from and learn from the other first.
Mm-hmm.
Care first. And the task will follow. Just does. You can get tasks done better, actually, when the dog is emotionally and physically better regulated. But this important, this principle about deciding who's judging things and what they're judging about, because the trainers that we're talking about have already decided. The brilliant Susan Garrett said on a podcast with Ivan and what his name was. The problem is for a lot of people on the aversive side of the training that they already feel they've got the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So when you feel that, all learning stops. And if you are stuck in a task-oriented mind, so in their mind, they're like, you know what, no, this is bad. I can do tasks, and I can do tasks really well. Then to be fair to them, then that's their view now, that's their perception, because mm-hmm. they're thinking about is getting tasks done. Mm-hmm. And they are really good at that, Karen. We've got to recognize they're good at getting tasks done from just a purely behavior on or off way.
Yeah,
it's done. What they don't know though at all, and what this is where we need to shine a light on this, is that they don't understand dogs at all. They understand how to challenge the behavior of another. So did the teacher who came to me at school, for example. And I'll add a bit of extra context into that. And this is where we start seeing the damaging layers of punishment, because
mm-hmm.
I had sexualized trauma when I was a child
mm-hmm.
from somebody outside of my family. That affected me as a young child, obviously, which started to affect my behavior. I felt I couldn't trust an adult to tell them. I couldn't even tell my parents. All my schoolmaster saw was Andy being annoying, Andy becoming more difficult, Andy becoming more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, Andy needs the cane. Because my actual unmet need underneath that just wasn't able to be met or to be heard. And that's just a very personal example, I think, of where we have to be really careful about the judgments that we make around the behavior of others.
Mm-hmm.
And especially dogs, right? Especially dogs, because I specialize in working with... inverted commas, aggressive dogs. Mm-hmm. I don't know that term, it's quite reductive, but that's what we call it. But
dogs and, that have the bigger emotions when they express them.
That's right. And the ones, actually, I would say about half my workload are dogs that would be classed as dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I've not met one dog in my whole career that fitted that category that wasn't in pain. Physical pain often.
Mm-hmm.
But also emotional pain and social pain. And these are real things for us and for dogs. And you can't make a dog safer to be around by making them feel less safe. And that is what is happening with these people. And they're often men. And they're often men who want to exert control and power and show that they can facilitate that from another. And there's a lot of connections, I think, between... some of the, you know, got to be careful here because I'm talking generally, I'm not talking mm-hmm. about anybody in specific, but between some of the male psychological output or psychological outlook, I should say, that leads to domestic violence
mm-hmm.
and those that end up using very harsh methods with dogs to get the same thing, because both are grounded in a notion of power and compliance. You mm-hmm. will do as I need you to do. Any perception of resistance to that will be met with force.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that poor animal is trying to tell you, I'm in pain. So it's really hard, and I feel for the general public, because they are their own brain, which has been indoctrinated into this good bad continuum, because say we all have this notion that, oh yeah, well, my dog, even though I love them, even though I know they're struggling, their behavior is bad, and this trainer is telling me I can deal with bad behavior. And for the caregiver's point of view, they're invariably stuck in task, even mm-hmm. though they care, mm-hmm. but they're stuck in task. So we're having a trainer who's feeding into their notion of task, which is somehow the results, you know, the means justify the end.
Yes.
When you and I work with these clients and we allow their brain to unlock the care side of their brain, because they already care anyway. By the way, if you're stuck in task, it doesn't mean you don't care, but the more the task is the objective, the less you can care, period. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. We've had these discussions before within the sports community.
I'm just going to jump in quickly. So little story of the weekend. So I've been away on holiday, had a lovely time, got back, and Sunday I had a competition booked, and Saturday I was teaching all day, had a brilliant weekend. Just quick shout out to Kirsty and Kat at the Bully Weekender, because I spent Saturday teaching Bull Terriers, which was just wicked, because they're a breed that you don't get a lot of in the wild. And there's definitely, you put your thinking cap on when you're training Bull Terriers, because they question you. They don't just go, oh, you would like me to do this. Okay, I can do this and get cookies. They go, why? And you're like, well, because, you know, there's this really good thing's going to happen at the end. They go, yeah, but why? Okay, but I've done it once. Why not? And people read that as, oh, they're being stubborn or they're bored. And to me, I just need to unlock the reinforcement. But yes, is that getting stuck in task? Falls back to that point. But on Sunday I was competing, and I'm not gonna lie, I'm overtired from being on holiday. We joked before we started recording that you go on holiday and need another holiday after to recover from the holiday you just went on, because oh my god. But also Dodge had had a week of shout out to Becky for looking after him while I was away, but he'd had a week living with two collies, so he'd had lots of stuff to do. And as much as he had a very chilled kind of Thursday and Friday, couple of decompression days, I didn't, because I had admin and other things to catch up on. So Sunday, got up early, packed up the van, realised it had a flat, changed the flat tyre, then got on the road, then went to the show. And I knew I shouldn't have gone. I knew I shouldn't have, because I was a bit tired and a bit sleepy, but, you know, paid my fees and want to go and see how he gets on, blah, blah. And honestly, it's probably the most disastrous show in terms of results I've had since we first started competing. Now, a lot of people would blame the dog. I'm straight away going, I think it was both of us combined. And I can see how it would be very easy. And there might be people going, oh, well, I'm sure it wasn't Dodge, it was you. I feel it was both of us, because we'd both had a week before and we were both just a little bit treat stacked. And actually, in the whole grand scheme of things, he tried to do what he thought I was asking. So I'm pretty sure that his sat nav was being really shit, e.g. me and my timing. But also I feel that his ears weren't maybe fully turned on to the listening to the sat nav. So I'm saying that we were equally as shit as each other and probably shouldn't have got to show.
Well, that just shows that I think, you know, I gave a talk recently at the Gun Dog Conference.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was really good to be invited, actually. And, you know, gun dog work is the ultimate task.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a task to do. And they were really responsive, because a lot of the things I was talking about regarding the notion that we all, human and the dog, need to be in as well-regulated state as possible to have a chance of being able to perform well.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about elite sports athletes, they don't get that win by training harder than they already do or doing more. They do it by, because they've already done the training, they've already worked hard. It's that emotional and mental capacity to stay well-regulated. Now, there's a confusion here about being well-regulated, because it's confused with being calm. And this is something, you know, when I talk about some of these things to agility colleagues or, you know, gun dog or whatever, mm-hmm. I don't want my dog calm. I need my dog to be up and running. But being well regulated isn't about being calm, it's cool, but being well regulated is regardless of what you're experiencing and the neurochemical responses, is that you can still hold it together. Stay focused, that's the point, rather than just flipping into a dysregulated state. So even just being tired, being, you know, a bit grumpy, a bit unwell, all these things affect us. And there's something called Yerkes-Dodson law, which is really important here when we think about stuff for doing sports and training. So if you imagine you've got like a bell shape, which is the graph. What Yerkes-Dodson said is that when you're down, so imagine that in front of you on the bottom left bit, where the kind of axis meets, you can't do much there because you're kind of too relaxed. Mm-hmm. You're not really picking up on it. And the more pressure you feel, the more you're kind of motivated, especially when we think about intrinsic motivation, then it gets you to the point that actually, yeah, that bit of stress that you experience is good because you're going to learn and you're motivated and that's great. But then there is a point where you go over that bell. And then you come down the other end. And this is what Yerkes-Dodson called the zone of delusion. I love that. It's such a cool thing. The zone of delusion. That's because the delusion is that by somehow working more, training more, you'll get better. But actually, it's the opposite. There comes a point where you're like, no, I can't. And we've all been there squatting up for exams, doing different mm-hmm. disciplines. So we have to recognize where that sweet point is for us and our dogs. Always. Yeah. This comes back to a care approach. We have to have care for us. And an important point there, by the way, just on the care for us. We talk about compassion fatigue a lot in our industry.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, compassion isn't finite. We don't have a little tub of it. And once we've dished out compassion, we haven't got any left. You can have infinite compassion for all around you. Compassion fatigue actually, for me, is a sign that we're lacking compassion for ourselves. That's the problem. So actually, you know, we're not particularly well regulated. We're already struggling in different ways. Mm-hmm. And that's just so looking at, so having that care for ourselves is a good point, but also then having that care approach for our dogs. Remember, care, the difference between task and care, because especially if we're still thinking about task, is that care is just about having the time to learn from the other first, mm-hmm. or to have a check-in with ourselves first. It's like, I'm just going to take a bit of care here. You know, can I really do another 4 hours flipping report writing? Or do I need to go and take the dogs out? So I think this is important for us. And one thing that is lacking completely and utterly with aversive training is care. Not in the sense of care from a Red Cross kind of care, although that is there, but also care in recognizing the experience of the one that you have in front of you. Whether it was that teacher who came to me, he wasn't mm-hmm. interested in anything else than the fact that my behavior was bad.
Yep.
To him. Or that dog who is whatever. And I try not to get into Facebook stuff because discussions with people, because it's not, you know, it's not helpful, I don't think. And I think where it's more powerful for you and I to lead by example. It's just mm-hmm. positive representation. It's like, okay, you know, you believe what you believe, that's fine. But sometimes you get into these little things, and I asked this one who actually came onto my page. Denise O'Moore did a great graphic for me with a dog having a shock collar put on, and mm-hmm. the bubble for the person was, this will teach you a lesson or whatever, you know, this will show you whatever. And the dog's little speech bubble was, I was just trying to tell you I was in pain. And I think it's just because it's a powerful thing. So anyway, a shock trainer came into my pet group and put their stuff. And he said, you're making all these assumptions that we don't know about this, this, and this. And I said, so do you know about the role of pain, physical pain, emotional pain, social pain? Do you know about the role of trauma? Do you know about the role of secure social attachments? I just listed these things. And he said, yes. And I said, well, if you do, and you're still using a shock collar, that's just really, really cruel now, mm-hmm. because you can't do both. Carry on. You can't understand those and then think that the shock collar is the approach, because you can't. The two are completely, they are just completely incompatible to know about both, you know, to know about that and still decide, even though you know that stuff, that you're still going to use something that is so harsh.
Barbaric.
Barbaric.
I am going to use the word, I'm putting it out there, because I mean, the listeners know my opinion, and if that makes me unpopular with people, then buttons, because everyone doesn't have to like me. I don't have to like everyone.
But the point is it really now? You know, maybe 10 years ago, I don't know, there could have been this notion of it's a matter of opinion. And, you know, you've got your way, we've got our way.
Yep.
We can't say that now. There is just too much science there to not only show the damaging effect of aversive, you know, these aversives.
To use one of my favourite sentences, because science. Right?
Science. I think science is, it's just there on so many levels now.
Yes.
I shared a review. I don't share my reviews often, but I shared one only because we've got a local shock jock trainer who's always saying unpleasant things about me and has made references about my sexuality and about that's why I'm a wussy kind of trainer. Yeah. Anyway,
I'm
just
sorry,
shows
what? That, like, you know, your sexuality has got nothing to do with your ability to train a dog. And if that's where that person feels the need to go, then they obviously feel threatened and need to, quite frankly, fuck off.
Well, yeah, thank you for
public service now.
So, but it just goes to show the mindset. Remember, this perception is like, okay, he's gay, therefore he must be quite weak and snowflakey, and that's why he can't deal with these dogs in the way that me, the big butch masculine man, can. Do you know what I mean? It's just this notion of masculinity, which is nuts, Carrie. And there's a bigger picture, and this fits what I was talking about earlier about some of the connections with domestic violence. It's not saying, mm-hmm. by the way, that people who use aversive as dog trainers are therefore domestic abusers, but there was quite a big study that's come out recently looking at the connections between domestic abuse and the use of these kind of tools, and the correlation between domestic abuse towards the woman in the home primarily, and other and animals in the home. And he said other animals then going, but I don't mean that about women. But this is important though, and it's important that we unpack this, I think. So the review was important because the client that I'd been working with this 50 some odd kilogram mastiff,
mm-hmm.
right, size of a bear,
mm-hmm.
had experienced this trainer and then had the chance to experience a different approach with me, and it was because this is real. This is a real life. It's a case of somebody who had been taken in by that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a dog with a bite history, a dog who could do harm. It's just so sad because the first thing this guy wanted to do when he met the dog was stick a shock collar on it without learning anything else at all. It's just nuts.
Seems very fucking lazy.
This is what happens, I'm afraid. This is what happens.
Like, I'm sorry, if that is your first port of call, then where else have you got to go from there? Because that just, I don't even understand the mentality of that.
Well, this is the norm, though, of course. And the wonderful Roman Gottfried, who's spoken with you, I think he's had has he been one of your guests, Roman?
I don't know if he has yet, but I'll cross on socials, but we will make that happen.
But anyway, Roman's amazing. So Roman is a trainer over in the States. He used to train with shock collars
because
mm-hmm. he was an engineer. He even invented better ones, right? So this is his story. And then he would see the dogs at the shelters and the different things where he was working, and they'd put the shock collar on, and he'd give the, and if they couldn't get near the dog, they'd, the person that was, you know, the caregiver, if they're working with the general public, they get the caregiver, the owner, to put the collar on. And he'd just happen, yeah, it works, and they're great, and the dog's reduced, now we come on. And then he was asked to take home a dog from the shelter, which he did, and he took the dog home, put the dog into the wherever, and then in the morning or whenever it was, I'm paraphrasing here a little bit for story, but the general principle is when he went to get the dog would not let him anywhere near the cage, the crate or whatever he was really going to get for him. And in that moment, two things happened for him. First of all, he realized, I'm nothing without this tool. And secondly, he saw the trauma in that dog's eyes, which reflected his own trauma. It's a powerful conversation. It's on my Dog Center Care channel. And which made him recognize why he'd ended up going down a very heavy control route. And this is something that we have to bear in mind again for those people who do this. And I do wonder whether for some who use these very, like you say, barbaric tools, actually, that they can't see the pain. They can't see more because of their own trauma, because of their own detachment from that process. Yep. And that was definitely what Roman experienced. So it's powerful stuff. Now, Roman is the biggest advocate. And, you know, he's just, that was his road to Damascus moment, right? He was just had an epiphany of all epiphanies. But so it just goes to show perception really is everything. And when I wrote my Phantom of the Opera piece quite a few years ago now, I had a lot of aversive balance trainers get in touch, actually, who read that. And they were like, now I've been feeling not quite right about this. All I've had it from the positive side is loads of pointy fingers and saying that I'm just, and in my brain, I'm thinking, well, I'm doing, you know, you're just showing me how to do tasks differently. But by reading that piece about thinking about the emotional experience of the dog and how any arbitrary changing of the behavior of another must be done thoughtfully. Because I wrote a piece a little while ago called Whose Behavior Is It Anyway? Which is an important question. So when I turn up to think about that dog's behavior, I have to be really mindful about going in there thinking I'm going to change the behavior of another in that arbitrary way. Because whether I use treats or whether I don't, the point is, the principal point is, how do I have the right to just turn up and say, you will do this because I expect you to. So they got in touch with me saying, reading it like that now makes me realize, now I know why it is I felt uncomfortable, actually. Because, you know, it's easy to stigmatize people who use aversives, but a lot of times it's just the way they've been taught. There's a lot of trainers, especially in the States, who are especially from kind of less well-off demographics, who don't have the income to go on nice courses like me and you and go on the very best and learn from the stuff. They learn from TikTok. They learn from the bloke on the telly, because they just don't know any different.
But I think as well, the expectations people have of what a dog is and how a dog should behave has changed massively.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I can remember being younger, and if one of the dogs growled, we would get in trouble because the dogs growled at us. Now that has been flipped completely. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, dogs are expected to not behave like dogs.
Well, definitely there's the room for them to communicate is taken away. This is what we alluded to at the beginning of the chat about the fact the general public have been, the one thing they have been convinced of is that their dog must be obedient and must be well-trained. The problem is everything becomes a training issue now. Dogs barking, dogs doing this, dogs doing that. You know, it's a training problem. When in fact it's a communication problem. So we've got a situation now where the general public generally know how to teach it, how to expect it, at all costs. I was in the vet surgery recently with one of my dogs, and a lady came in to weigh her dog. He was petrified, managed to get the dog on the scale, petrified, and then spent the next 2 or 3 minutes making the dog sit on the scales. And it's like, the dog's on the scales, just weigh the bloody dog, you know? But, they know how to teach sit, they might know how to teach recall, all that kind of stuff, but they don't know what pain looks like. They don't know what body language is. They don't know what stress looks like. They don't know about social processing, all the kind of stuff. So I think we have to think about how we educate. And if we're educating through task-based lessons, which is dog training lessons, which is cool, and to make sure that we're injecting in the other stuff and being able to say, do you know what? I think Rover needs time out right now, or Rover's not feeling today, and that's absolutely fine. In fact, why don't we see if Rover would like to do this activity instead, rather than just having the classes that are just so kind of heavily attuned to task anyway. Because that's the problem with our schooling system. Our schooling system is very heavily biased towards structured learning, structured education.
Because you have a curriculum and you have to meet the curriculum to pass the exams to get your qualifications.
And that's the point, because it's heavily based on attainment. not achievement. Some of these kids, the fact that they're in school today, even though they're hungry, even though they're stressed, even though they're traumatized, even though they're whatever, is an achievement for that child. And then those children who are struggling with that kind of setup, and that will come out in dysregulated behaviors because their brain's designed to dysregulate. So they're wiggly bum, they're being silly, they're the class clown, they're going to the asking to go to the loo every 2 minutes, all this kind of stuff. They're the ones who are seen as being disruptive, naughty, difficult.
I mean, I feel like you've just described my general school day, but you know, hey.
Well, many people experience their first real experiences of trauma through just being at school, and it affects us. So there's a good, I've said this before, I know, but there is a difference between what we're taught and what we learn. School is about what you get taught. Well, guess what? You're not going to remember much of what you get taught, but you will still be affected by it. I'm in my 50s now, Karen. You're still a young lady, but even
God I still, bless you, I'm not that young, but
I still remember what I learned from school, what I learned about being caned, for example, at that time, what I learned about my abilities to kind of communicate with my peers at the time and all this kind of stuff. These
Oh,
things
I
stick
still
with me.
have a negative association around maths.
Yeah, well, I'm
Right.
not surprised. Oh, God, thank God for calculators, eh? But yeah, I think this is the point. So when we think about our dogs, then I saw a video recently of a dog, great trainer, trying to get the dog to do the task. Dog was struggling to do the task, so all the usual mechanisms to try and get the dog to get the task done. I saw a dog who was really struggling and wanted exits, but was still there doing it. So yes, the dog ended up being taught the thing, but what did the dog learn about the ability to be able to communicate and say, "No, I can't right now," or "This is too much"? What did that dog learn regarding their relationship with that person? I think a bond gets stronger through the ability to say no, not because we can say yes.
So going back to the competition on Sunday, because it's just kind of a little light bulb in my head of this being a really good example of that. On one of the runs, Dodger was doing amazing, and we literally had, I think, five hoops left in the course, and he was clear and he was doing amazing. But he was on the far side of the ring. So by now he's 10, 12 meters away from me, which is a fair distance. And there was another ring next door, and there was a queue of dogs. And as he came down the line, he turned and he ran back to me. And I was like, dude, what, like, what? Now, I could have got really, really cross with him, but I recognized the way he came up to me was him going, Mama, no, I can't. And I was like, that's okay. I went, okay, can we try again? And I sort of moved a bit closer, sent him out again. And he ran back to me. So I went, all right, what if I run with you? And he ran all the way to the end. Hubby was by the gate and ran to Daddy, and everything was cool and it was fine. And afterwards, I was like, why did he do that? And I think it was because of the queue and everything else I've said, you know, I was tired, he was tired, blah, 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 blah. But 2 years ago, he would have got to that point of seeing those other dogs, he would have charged the fence and he would have lost his shit. He made a really good boy choice of going, Mom, I'm not comfortable. Because now he goes, oh, to steal Kim Brophy's analogy, because I always do, Sheriff, I need backup. Whereas he used to go, yeah, you can be the deputy, I will deal with this. Now he goes, I need you to help me. And I'm like, that's cool, bud, that's fine. There have been a few times at comp, I've when it's got very busy or whatever, and he's just come to me and I'm like, that's cool, bud, let's just stop. We'll have a play and we'll leave the ring. Because I don't have anything to prove now. But if my brain was focused on task, we have to get the ribbons, we have to get the trophies, we have to do this, we have to do that, would I get cross with him? Would I? Now, there was one point where, in fact, twice on Sunday, I asked him to do something. He didn't listen. We had a communication error. I called him into me, popped him in a down, went, right, can we try that again? And he went, oh, okay. And then did it beautifully. Now, that's the way we work together. I say to him, dude, that wasn't what I asked you to do. Please come here a minute, lay down. Let's just both process, and now we'll carry on. Now, I know for a fact there'll be people listening going, well, why didn't you just take him out the ring then? Because he enjoys the Hoopers. We're having fun doing a thing together. So I don't want to take that completely away from him. But if I get entrenched and we have to do task, this is where you can end up with that slippery slope of harsh handling happening and stuff like that. And where I feel that, you know, with trainers that are so committed to task, the care side comes out of it for both parts of the team.
100%. And I think this is just such an important thing that we have to talk about, because, you know, we see the same even in elite sports. You know, there was that famous thing at the Olympics with the horse and the woman who ended up punching the horse, the rider. Mm-hmm. In that heat of the moment, her brain was just on, this is, you know, so, you know, almost treating the horse like a tool that needed to be done. And I think I would invite everybody who's involved in dog sports just to kind of have times of reflection and reevaluation, check in.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of people who, especially in my kind of group and on that kind of emotional focus side of thinking about dogs, who don't like dog sports for this reason, and that is because of those who give the dog sports a bad rap, because they are expecting the dog to do it, and in their mind they think that their dog's having the most amazing time, where everybody can see the dog probably isn't, and they're not taking those brave decisions like you've done. It's okay, because the thing is, I would say this, this comes back to gun dogs again. So some of the dogs in the dogs who are trained to do proper, as in to do the job, not just to do it for fun, as in competitions, but to be out working.
Yeah.
They're bred not particularly well. They're extremely neurophysy, these kind of spaniel types. And actually their working life is about 3 years, and then they're shot. It's nuts, isn't it, when you think about it? So actually that's because there's no care. Task, where the dog's not getting the chance to decompress and have any choices or any kind of life away from being in a kennel or working. And I hear this a lot, and it's one of my little peeves, really, which is like, oh yeah, you got to remember they're not a domestic, they're not a companion dog, they're a working dog. It's like, oh yeah, that's okay then. Their emotional needs don't matter then, because of that. What's with amazing people like Leanne Smith and Jules Morgan and others who are working in a positive way with these
Jane
dogs.
Arden.
Yeah, Jane Arden. Jane was at the conference I was talking about, actually, amazing. Putting care first. The thing is, you have times when the dog can't necessarily perform tasks well, and you accept that and you recognize it. But guess what? They're more likely to come back next time ready to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And their working life is hugely expanded. It's this, I would invite people to think about that when you're doing competitions. It's better to have a couple where you kind of put your hands up and think, my dog's not feeling it today, and you know that's going to be tough for me because I wanted them ribbons, but you know what, we'll come back bigger and stronger next time. It's a much better outlook, I think. Otherwise you're just going to get a dog who, if they get, they might keep getting those things in the ring, but I've worked with a lot of dogs who end up developing a lot more behavioral challenges away, because the ability to kind of communicate safety and communicate connection, you know, Dodge really had a moment with you and you were there for him, and you cannot beat that connection.
But I think, like, coming, like, a phrase that I know from the horse world is them going stale. And one of the things I've looked at is, right, so obviously it's the summer in the UK, so we're right in the middle of competition season. I'm like, oh, okay, we've got a busy couple of months coming up with competition, this and that. So now I need to start looking at the other things, like, you know, him having his Librella. So this is the other thing. I know he's due his Librella this week. So that could be another factor that adds into our performance as a team at the weekend. But also things like, do I need to look at adapting his diet a bit more because he's going to be using a bit more calories? Is it that I need to look at his kind of exercise outside of Hoopers? But also, do I need to add an extra decompression day in a week so that he can get his brain chemicals back to where we need them? And there's all these little factors. And I've also kind of gone, and part of it is because I'm going to be in Australia teaching, But I've looked and I've gone, do you know what? He's going to have September, October pretty much off. He's going to have a good 6-8 weeks off of Hoopers where there won't be training, there won't be competitions. And then we're ready for the winter season. And each year is going to be slightly different with him, you know, because he has his hip dysplasia, because I need to look at all of this other stuff that's happening. But I think this is where it can be really hard for the public, that one day their dog's doing okay, and then all of a sudden these things start happening. And if we're not going to look at, well, what's caused the behavior change? You know, one of the first things as a trainer, if someone's, oh, the dog's suddenly doing this, have they had a vet check recently? And I don't just mean them going to the vet and the vet making sure there's the right number of ears, eyes, legs, and tails that were there to start with. I mean, a proper vet check. Have you run bloods? People look at me like I'm mad when I tell them I run bloods every year for my dogs. Because I want a base level.
It's important. I think, you know, seeing physios regularly, all these kind of things, I think they all really help. And this is the key for me, I think. You've really explained that beautifully, as always.
Thank you.
If we don't have some opportunity for the dog to communicate their struggles, their genuine struggles, then we've got bigger problems down the line. And I think there's two really simple things that we can do here. First is to recognize that everything we ask the dog is a request. Ultimately, we can call it whatever we like, but the bottom line
is
the dog
is a cue, not a command.
Well, exactly. But even as a cue, I think the thing is, even as a cue, you know, we have to see it as a cue in the purest form of it being I'm going to cue this. Seeing it as a request. If you want to use the word cue, but you're still expecting the dog to do it, it does become a command. I think that you have to bear that in mind. Yeah. But so if that means a request, because the dog will either do it or they won't. And if they won't, to recognize one of the most fundamental things for me and all my clients that I get them to recognize is that everything is feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is feedback. So Dodge gave you feedback.
Yep.
Now, we might not like the feedback sometimes, but it's feedback.
Yeah. And I think, did it cost us a blooming ribbon? Dagnabbit. I'm joking, by the way, if people can't take my sarcasm, but
we have lots of ribbons here, darling. We shall send you some.
To be fair, it's not like we're short of them this year. It's it's been a while though since I've been at a show and gone, nuts. That was a bit shit.
But this is why everything's feedback, because even your own looking back, discussing it today, it's feedback. It's like, okay, do you know what? I recognize I wasn't feeling it. Dodge probably wasn't feeling it. Also, you know, you've been away on holiday and Dodge had gone to stay wherever he'd gone to stay, and I'm sure he's very happy there, but he wasn't with mom. And all these things come about. And I think we have to just do two things for me. One is to be humble enough always to take that feedback and think, okay, you're not feeling it now. Let's try again later, right? I'm still not getting the same results as I used to get. You're not as sharp as you used to be. I need to start exploring that. What are you trying to tell me here? Because we're buddies and I care for you, and care comes first, and who cares about the other stuff? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is to give ourselves grace to get it wrong and to screw up. Because we do, and that's fine. And you know, sometimes if you are in the heat of the moment and we lose sight of some stuff, then that's okay too, because we're human beings, and you know, we have to give ourselves grace. So I think that this is the important thing with all this stuff, isn't it? I think it just comes down to that. It's we have to, the more we ask of our dogs. And this was the main pitch for me at the Gun Dog Conference when I finished giving my talk on this stuff. The more we ask for our dogs, the more we owe it to them to give them good work life conditions. We'd want the same, right? The more we ask, the more we need to give them the to make sure that they're doing things. And you know yourself, because you're a champion at what you do and you work in a compassionate way. So it shows it works. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at things over a period of time, the success is clear to see. It doesn't matter if you have these bad days, off days, mm-hmm. for you or the dog.
But I think as well, it's important to remember that, what was it I said to someone the other day? It's not a mistake if you've learned from it. Because that's how I feel. Like, if something goes wrong and I can go, right, why did that happen? What was it? I've been videoing stuff for a new course I'm going to be presenting. It'll be in Australia first and then it'll come to the rest of the world. But Australia gets first dibs this year on the new one. And I'm looking at lines and how dogs move and how course design will affect dogs' movement and therefore either set the dogs up for success or set the dogs up for failure. And this is one of the other things I'm becoming really passionate about within a sport as a judge, is that I want to set the dogs up for success. I want to set the course out that if the dog understands the concept of basically take the next obstacle in front of you unless your handler tells you different, that they'll go, this is my line, this is where I need to go. One of the things that I find running other judges' courses is that I don't think that's always a consideration.
Yeah.
And that's where there are times where I can tell you where my dog is going to go wrong. I can tell you exactly where we're going to get faults. And you know what? I will try and correct my steering and help him to get the course that was intended by the judge. But if he gets faults on those points, and some of it is due to his physicality, this is not judge bashing anyway. Some of it is because I know that it's like steering the QE2. And if you're trying to do something in a tight turn, it doesn't always work because I'm not driving a small mini. I'm literally driving a truck. And some of the maneuvers just aren't possible for him. So if he gets faulted for that, oh my God, I'm not going to be cross for him. I'm not cross for me. I'm not cross with the judge because it was just that test on that day wasn't the one for us. But I don't think that all, and even trainers are guilty of this at times in not reducing criteria or not setting the dog up for success. We've all set an exercise and the dog just hasn't been able to complete that task. It's our job as trainers to go, right, hang on a minute. My bad, that might be too hard. Let's just look at what we're doing. What's happened with the dog today? Is it because this? Is it because that? It could be that, you know, there are so many facts in it that one of the things I hear so often in the dog world is, yeah, but they know that. They know how to do that. But do they?
Yeah. This comes back to that task care thing again, because on a different day, different time, different place, they might know it better.
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of things, you know. Oh God, how many times do we I was on a podcast a little while ago and very confidently said, you know, this
another
three...
podcast, not another... my one, how rude.
I have to fill the gap between C and U. and I said with much gusto and confidence, do you know, there's three really important things that we have to remember when we think about working with aggressive dogs. And then I couldn't remember any of them. So somebody say, well, do you know it? And I'm like, I do know it, but I'm also quite stressed and I'm very tired and you know, blah blah blah, and all the other things that have gone on, and my brain cells just decided to pull up that drawbridge today. And I think about dogs like that sometimes, especially these dogs who might go to a weighted competition. I've had a lot of clients, you know, who've gone to I've got an amazing colleague locally who does agility, and she's really amazing, and they get a lot from it. And then they're amazing. And then my colleague's like, you know, let's go to the county show, and because you're amazing. And it's surprising how many times the dogs just don't do well on those days because they've never done anything other than where they normally go, and it's the first time, and they've been traveling, and there's lots of people about. And I use the doors of the brain analogy, because if we imagine our brain, the dog's brain has lots of little doors in it. We need as many doors to stay open for free-flowing information and for things to be in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. Pain, trauma, and stress are big door closers. Tiredness, big door closer. Any kind of big emotional response at the time is a big door closer. It just is. So, yeah, I think this is just something we've got to bear in mind. And And especially going back to Yerkes Dodson again, when we're past the, when the dog's not at that peak bit on the curve and they've gone past it for whatever reason, training more, shouting more, yanking more, whatever you want to do, just ain't going to do it. And in fact, guess what? It's like to shut even more doors now.
But then this is where as well, though, proofing is so important. And, you know, the phrase that always comes into my head is, well, the proof is in the pudding. And it's like, yeah, but if you haven't proofed it, the pudding's going to taste shit. Because, again, that just that going to a different environment, that was part of the layers of why the weekend didn't work, because it's the first time we'd been to that show. And whenever I'm at a new showground, I'm more aware. Dodge is more aware. All these little things happen. The weekend coming up, it's our local showground. It's only a 30-minute drive from home. We've been there 3 times this year already. He knows where he's going. His mates are there and everyone's having a lovely time. It's a totally different picture for both of us. So therefore, we're setting ourselves up for success more. And I think that we forget as people how much we ask of dogs to generalize things they've learned. Because I can tell you, Munchkin, God rest her, our little fatted girl, her talking about like changes of hormones is another thing that plays a massive part. Because I can tell you that dog, in the training field during her teenage stage, she was delightful. And then you'd get her out of the training area. And oh my God, what the fuck happened to my lovely, well-trained dog? Because I tell you, the loose lead, the recall, all the good stuff she could do perfectly in a training field that we went to every week on a Wednesday and a Sunday or whatever days they were we were training. Monday at the local park was not the same thing. And I think that that's the other thing with this lovely creature of mine. I'm going to jinx it a little bit, but I think we're out of adolescence. He's 4 next week. I don't know how he's made it to 4. I don't know how I've survived him till he's made it to 4. But I feel now like I can kind of not disclude the hormones, but they're definitely not as big a factor as they were 2 years ago.
And you know, it doesn't matter. Even for us humans, we're unique in as far as we have a kind of big prefrontal cortex, and our thinking brain is really big, and it helps us moderate our behavior better and cope better. But even if we're well prepared for something, even if we're, you know, I spoke at the Association of Dogs and Cats Homes conference last year.
Mm-hmm.
And even something as silly as me getting my time right wrong for me talking. So I don't know my prep already, but instead of like thinking I've got another hour, I had like 5 minutes. So you just go in and so you just get yourself into a bit of a pickle, right? And I think I must have delivered the first 10 minutes of my talk in about 30 seconds, because you just go, because you go into automatic thing. This is where we have to bear that in mind for dogs doing sports, because it can be very easy for a dog to go into their automatic thing, so they'll do it. But we still have to make sure we're checking in all the time to make sure that they're feeling it. Mm-hmm. And that they're present, because that's important for us. And so yes, I think all these things are really important. And I think, like say, proofing, I think if you're going to start doing things with dogs in different places at different times, you want them at least to have experiences of doing different things in different places, not necessarily even the sport itself, just generally getting that dog to have more emotional resilience for stuff, because it's very helpful. But and also to plan stuff out. I think, you know, I've got some friends who are just really into the shows and that, and they're always looking for the next one. And before you know it, their summer's virtually every weekend, they're off doing something with huge travel in sometimes. Put your finger on it.
Hi, yeah, I'm the problem. It's me.
And it's not a problem if, like you, that you're checking in, that we're okay, because it's a very arbitrary thing, right? This Saturday, 11 o'clock, my dog's going to be doing a run around a ring somewhere. It's fixed.
Yep.
The dog isn't able to say, actually, do you know what? I think my hamstrings playing up a little bit this weekend, or I went to the I had a bad experience when that dog attacked me on Thursday, and I just need a bit of decompression time. So we just have to keep an eye on. It's not just about in the moment. I love the things that you share with Dodge and his day-to-day stuff, because you're always thinking about his general life. Because he's a sensitive boy, you have to think about that. I invite all my clients to look at their dog's nervous system over a 7-day cycle. So you get a better idea then about what they're experiencing and the stuff they need to get rid of a little bit before they have capacity for anything else, you know?
Yeah. It's one of the reasons as well, though, why I was so honest with him on social media and to the world. And I feel like there is a pressure on us as professionals to have these perfect dogs. But what is the perception of perfect? Because I'm not going to lie, the two puppy dogs that I've got fast asleep right now in the kitchen while we are talking, they're both on their beds, they're both fast asleep, we're having lovely chat. That to me is, going back to that phrase, a well-trained dog, because they've gone, oh, she's on the computer, she's chatting, might as well go to sleep because there's nothing else going to happen.
I think what it shows more importantly is that they're well-regulated dogs, that they have what they need and they can relax and chill out. You haven't trained them, in inverted commas, to go and be in that place while you're on the computer. I think about, we've got three dogs, and the most important thing I want them to feel is safe, and the ability to be able to find good rest times. A lot of the dogs that I go and see, the dog just isn't getting enough rest, true proper, switch off rest. And if the home environment specifically doesn't feel a safe space all the time, that's tough for these dogs, really tough. So yeah, I hear you on that. And I think we have to make sure that we're not projecting unrealistic expectations onto our dogs, really. I gave a talk the other day for CAM, Canine Arthritis Management, on the 3 A's, or 4 A's, really, because I think it gets to a better place when you learn to truly advocate for your dog.
Yep.
A lot of the effects of other people's judgments on you and the expectations you feel go away. And that starts with awareness is the first day. So we have to become aware.
Yep.
And that's what care is all about. Is how do I become more aware about my dog's care and support needs? Forget about the behavior. Forget about the fact that they're pissing me off. Forget about whatever it is that I'm experiencing. How do I become aware? Awareness for me is about growth. When we truly become more aware of our lived experience, our dogs, about other people's, then we grow. The next day is acknowledgement. Is okay, I'm aware of that now, and now I need to acknowledge it. Now, acknowledgement can be hard. There can be all sorts of reasons why we struggle with acknowledgement, our own kind of belief systems, value systems, our own kind of safe worldview can make that hard. But the next A is the way, is the final A is the one we want to get to, which is acceptance, which is okay, I accept that. I accept my dog can't do this, that, and the other at the moment. I accept that my vision for having a dog is now changed, and I accept that. And then with true acceptance, not flippant acceptance, true acceptance, comes the ability to advocate, which is, do you know what? I'm doing my run today, or went a bit tits up. I don't care if that person over there is laughing or that judge is looking at me like, why in the hell are they even here? I'm advocating for me and my dog. I don't give a toss. Yeah. I'll do what's best for me and my dog ultimately, because that relationship is more important to me than anything else.
And actually, one of the things that was lovely at the weekend, after he'd gone 1, 2, 3, 15, I was like, dude, what was wrong with 4? 4 was right there. He was like, yeah, but 15 was also kind of in my line, so I went for that one. I set him up again, and the judge went, don't worry, my collie does things like that. And it was so lovely to just have that little bit of understanding from a peer to go, it's cool, don't panic, don't stress. And you know what? After I'd reset him, the run was exquisite, and it was beautiful, and it was lovely, and we were connected, and he did all the stuff. And I think part of it is, full honesty, because I knew I'd already been eliminated, all the pressure was off.
Yeah.
Because it's not a competition anymore, because we've already fucked it. So now we're just doing it for shits and giggles. And that is one of the things that I'm still working on in the ring, is taking off the pressure and us just having fun. Because as much as, yes, dog sports are fun, I am also a competitive person. It's part of my upbringing, you know, and the goal is to be the winner. That's the upbringing I've been within, you know, being youngest with two big brothers. It's very competitive. So it just makes it kind of, I have to remind my brain to accept sometimes this is what we have to do. And I think that that's one of the things that can sometimes be hard when we're working with teams of dogs, whether it's in sport or just, you know, people living in a home with their dog and they're finding these problems. Is the problem actually a problem for them, or is it a problem for them because society has said it's a problem?
Oh, yeah, I hear that. I shared a post recently that the kind of headline was that our dogs are not broken based on another person's version of normal. And this is, there's bigger picture stuff here again about our own self-esteem and our own, how that just gets eroded away by the expectations and judgments of others. Because, from a very young age, when our comparative brain first kicks in about 3 or 4 and then is fully online about 5, guess what? We're starting school where everything's about comparing you to others and the kind of expectations and judgments and coming out. So it's really hard. And I think when you're very competitive as a person, I spoke to a lady a little while ago who does big agility stuff, really, and she's really competitive. And she realized early on her competitiveness was forcing her to overlook her dog's care and support needs. Mm-hmm. She heard somebody at one of the agility things talking about this side of things, and it really made her think, oh God, and I'm not even checking anymore. So she said to me, I've shifted that competitiveness now. Mm-hmm. As to being the best carer I can be to my dog with these things. That's the thing that I compare myself and have as my competitive goal. Mm-hmm. And she said something very similar to you, you know, like you said right at the beginning of the hour, you know, if you have care first, task will follow, and it will follow really well. So I think we just have to check in sometimes. When we're really passionate about something, that's fine. And we can do what we want to ourselves in the pursuance of our goal. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you have another that you take along with you, a partner, a dog, a child, then we owe it to them to just make sure we're getting that feedback from them and making sure that we have that care approach. Because we see the same with young kids and sports, mm-hmm. you know, over competitive parents, you know, the kind of, you know, the dad's on the side of the football pitch screaming and shouting and like all that, and all the kind of pressure and kind of reliving their life through their kids. And that we see it in lots of fields, actually. And we know, actually, for many children who were pushed into doing things when they were young because the parents decided you are going to play cricket, you are going to be a great guitarist, you're going to do ballet, whatever. Because we know when they're adults and they feed this back, especially through therapy, that it was traumatic for them. It was hard for them because they didn't have an exit. They didn't feel that they were listened to. So I think that, you know, we have to think about the same for our doggies, really, sometimes.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that is very interesting, because as much as we were competitive, we were always, as kids, say, me and my brothers, were given the opportunity to pick the sports we did. I mean, I feel my brothers were probably steered towards football a lot more than I was, because dad was very into football and that's what he did. But I know from my point of view, I look back and I did dance for a bit, and I did gymnastics for a bit, and I did swimming for a bit. But actually, it was horses stole my heart, and then eventually dogs. And one thing I find so interesting is that a lot of people that did horse sports when they were younger are now in the dog sport world. And I joke it's because we can't afford ponies anymore, so now we've got dogs, because at least you can keep them indoors and you're only paying one lot of rent instead of your own and the stable. Mm. But I think that is part of it. It's that having, for me, dog sport is, this is just my experience, but having, because Dodge is my first dog that I've done sport with properly, you know, and competitively. And don't get me wrong, the girls did all the sports and all the fun stuff, but Dodge is the one that I think, honestly, the teamwork we have. We are a team, and it is a very different, in ways, it is a very different relationship to what I have to the girls. I don't think it's better or worse, it's just
Yeah,
different.
different.
And, you know, I mean, obviously, was devastated when we lost Chica and Munch earlier in the year, and Minx, that I joke, is now my sofa ornament, but I never competed properly with Minx because Minx always found the competition environment a bit much. So I picked and chose and kind of should do it for fun, and is the star of many a Hooper's World video. But when it comes to the flashy showing off in the real world stuff, that's where the boy comes in. And we kind of both are front and center and find our sparkle and show the world what we can do. Whereas the girls, in a way, didn't have that pressure on them.
I hear you. Relationships are complicated, right?
Yeah.
You have them for all sorts of reasons, friendships, romantic relationships. They, our dogs specifically, I think, they're more to us than just companions. They represent so much more. I think about Arthur at the moment because he's an old boy now and he's getting on a bit and he's been my boy, right? And his eyes saw my mother. My mother's not here anymore. Even my own husband never saw my mother. It's all things and he's the Milo, who is my soul dog, really. He's not with us anymore.
Yeah.
And I look back at that and I think one of the reasons we had such an impactful relationship is because I was just recovering from my drug addiction and breakdown when Milo came along. I just started working with dogs and I wanted a dog that I could learn from and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't have any other dogs. It was just me and Milo. And I often say that I rescued him, but he saved me. So these things are deep. And so I hear you on that. And this is why I would caution to colleagues who are just very anti-dog sports, period. Because for me, I think if you stay humble enough, have a care approach, and are prepared to honestly take feedback from your dog, honestly, because sometimes we think the dog loves it, but guess what? They don't. Then there can be a huge amount of benefit in relationships through doing these activities together. I see it. I see it. I hear what my colleagues say who are anti some of these things, and you know what? They're right on all these things, but that doesn't mean that all those things apply to every single thing. That's the point, and this is the thing we have to be careful with. And equally on the other side, I when those people list those things, people who do the dog sports, and they think, well, you're talking about me, aren't you? And I'm not, because I'm not with it. And so you get the two extremes, really. But I think these conversations are just about us just being grounded enough and thinking about care first. I think that's it. Turning up, seeing how you do things. I remember my grandfather used to take me fishing. I didn't like fishing,
No, I can't do
but
fish.
I,
I did it once. It was horrible. I didn't like it. No.
and that's how I felt. Now, luckily we were crap, so we didn't catch anything, but I loved my granddad. I didn't see him very much and I loved being with him. And there were days when it was peeing down with rain, and he'd look at me and he'd be like, oh, do you want to go to McDonald's? Or whatever it was back then. I think it was Wimpy back then. Or whatever it was. Or do you want to go and get a
Oh my
milkshake?
God, a Wimpy.
Yeah,
There's going to be a
Wimpy.
certain demographic, this
I
demographic.
think they
I remember Wimpy.
were great, weren't they? You felt there was a bit of care put into that burger when you had that. And there's a bit of lettuce on it, a bit of whatever. The point I'm thinking is he wanted to go fishing and he wanted me to go with him, and he could tell I wasn't really into it. I wanted to be there though, because I wanted to be my granddad, but he also recognized when I wasn't feeling it. And he thought, let's do something a bit more Andy today then instead. And that's what it's about, really. It
Yeah.
wasn't a case of, look, please shut up, stop moaning, whatever it is that I, or sit there with the fishing rod and you'll do as you're told. It wasn't like that. It was a connected thing. But so I think and some dogs have an aptitude. I remember Arthur, when he was younger, going to see my friend who does the agility locally. And I went up there with cream cakes, as you do, because that's the main thing I go to see her for, having a cream cake and a natter. You know, Arthur did that whole thing. He'd never done it ever before in his life. He was about 7 months, 8 months. I think with Arthur, he'd come from a barn when I met him, and it was a three-layer barn, and I think he just developed really good proprioception young. And so he had no fear, and he was really good at stuff. And me and Jan just watched him, and she said, you know what, I get dogs like that. They don't need any training. They need to be shown to do things to slow stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
He just went round, he went through the tunnel, he went over, he just did it because he wanted to. It was great. And I think, I think we just have to be a little bit more mindful, but be honest. That's the only thing I'd ask anybody who does anything that is expectational with another, even with our partners, right?
Yeah.
We all do stuff with our partners that we don't particularly want to do, because we love them, which is great. But it would be a shame.
What you mean, like my poor husband being in a field full of, quote, middle-aged women watching dogs run around all weekend?
Yeah, or me being submersed into Dolly Parton 24 hours a day, which is my
husband. Oi, careful with what you say about Miss Dolly. You know that you're...
Well, there you go. Maybe you and Kieran would be a good matchup. But we want sometimes for kind of partners, our loved ones, to kind of acknowledge the fact, I know you're not feeling it, but... thank you. Or to say, do you know what, I know you're not feeling, so you don't have to come if you don't want to. Yeah. So Kieran's off to Dollywood next year. I'm not going. He's going with his Dolly friends, and I can see the joy in him, actually, because I could go and I'd probably just be traipsing around, not really getting it, but he's going with his Dolly mates, he's gonna have a great time. So that's just what we do, I think. So that's the lesson from today. This is what I would say, bringing it full circle, about the what is missing for those who are balance of reversive trainers, actually, mm-hmm. is this notion of task at all costs. And with that dog I was talking about earlier, the big dog, the last session I had just before the review, I was able to be with the dog, no muzzle. He was just like, yeah, because he's a loving dog, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You would never get that ever through aversive means, that a dog willingly giving themselves to you in the moment. It was a beautiful moment, and we're always careful, but he was just showing all the signs, and we were okay, and I just said, I want to take them and let the muzzle off, and he was just so loving, and because he felt safe. It is as simple as that. Every time, you know, if the dog feels safe, then we're good. If they don't, but so these are beautiful moments, aren't they?
I think as well, kind of my sort of for the people that are anti-dog sport, if you like, please don't think that everyone is completely task orientated, because I can tell you from seeing, obviously I'm in Hoopers, but I'm around a lot of agility people and stuff, and it's dog first, sport second. Friends that do obedience, same mantra. And yes, not everybody has that attitude, but there is a huge, huge percentage that we're doing sport with our dogs because we enjoy doing it together. And a lot of the dogs that we are doing sport with, I would argue, would not thrive without having that task.
Well, no, exactly. And this is the thing, having a care. I think this is, and I agree with you. I think this is what I think I would invite anybody to do on both sides. So those who do sports well, just to be able to take stock and think, right, am I injecting enough care first? Because that's mm-hmm. always the way to go. And those who are very much anti-dog sports, I get it. But don't dismiss the real benefits of relational bonds that go on with it. And because I just see it myself. I've worked with dogs who struggle with safety,
mm-hmm.
who end up, I've got great colleagues locally, scent work, agility, Hoopers, lots of different things that go on.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's a case of let's just give things a try and see what the dog thinks. This is quite cool. So there's no kind of like, dog won't do it, make them do it.
Yep.
But when they pick that thing that they love, now they have something that's like a safety connection, which mm-hmm. is like, I can't do close-up stuff, but I can connect to you in this way. And the bond builds quite quickly, and I see it a lot. And it's a beautiful thing, but there's never an exact science on all these things. I think it comes back to this thing about being humble and just taking everything as feedback and making sure we're available to that feedback, even if it's not feedback we want.
Exactly that. All feedback is information. It's what we do with the information that's important, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we've got one of our neighbors. She got a dog. This is always dangerous, I think, everybody. She got this dog with the express view of doing agility. Mm-hmm. She's got an older dog who loved agility. So mm-hmm. I'm going to get this dog to agility. She's now kind of getting on for, the dog's about 2 years old now and probably about mm-hmm. 12 months into doing the agility. And she's now realized, the feedback is, my dog don't like it. And she's just accepted that. And I think that's really cool. I said, you can do stuff that you find enjoyment. But so she almost feels a little bit of grief there, a little bit yes. of grieving, because she thought, yes. But it's always a gamble, a punt, especially if you get a puppy thinking this dog will be this. Because, you know, when you think about guide dogs, for example, they spend millions on a breeding program. Uh-huh. And only about 4 out of 10 dogs get through. So even right. trying to do things right, you're not going to necessarily guarantee
police breeding programs, same thing. Not all police puppies are going to make police dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. And just because it's a collie doesn't mean it's going to want to do agility, you know, or just because it's a spaniel means it's going to love gun dog work. You know, I think this is the thing about just recognizing that would be nice, you know. Yeah. My parents wanted me to be a piano playing solicitor, you know, and have lots of grandkids, but they couldn't.
How did that work out?
Every one of those, they didn't get any of them. So this is the point. Expectations are cool, but just be humble enough to think, that's not Andrew's story. That's not my dog's story.
Yeah.
And it's much easier just to kind of go through awareness, acknowledgement, acceptance, and then think, it's okay. Because the thing is, if we focus in on the one thing we don't have, we risk the fact of losing sight of the huge amount of stuff that we do. Yeah,
exactly that. Well, Andrew, thank you so, so much for joining me. So if people want to find out more about Cake and Care and all the other good stuff we've been talking about, where do they find you on the Bookface?
On the Bookface. So Cake, just to kind of let people know, is compassion, awareness, knowledge and empathy. We discussed this before. But because we all, you know, those four things there, if you turn up with those, you can't go far wrong. Mm-hmm. And it happens to spell Cake, which is always good. So Dog Centre Care is my YouTube group. And also Dog Centre Care on Dog Centre Care on Facebook is my Facebook group, and Dog Centre Care on YouTube, where we've got loads of amazing conversations. Thinking about the emotions for me, you know, Karen, I'm lucky because I get to educate on lots of different places and stuff, and it's always an invitation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, let's just think about stuff. It's not right, this is the way you do it, that's wrong, this is right. It's just an invitation to think about stuff. I think we have to draw a line when we think about some of these horrendous tools,
mm-hmm.
because you know, they are just abusive. They just are. I'm sorry if that's upsetting for people, especially if you're a caregiver and you've used the tool, and I totally get it. And especially if you've been advised to use, I totally get it. But that doesn't stop us from having to step back and really evaluate why we have used a tool
mm-hmm.
that is called a shock collar, a mm-hmm. prong collar, a choke chain. And that's normally because of our own kind of being stuck in task ourselves. And if we step back and if we think, well, it works, what we really mean by that is it works for us.
Yep.
That's what it really means. And if that's our primary goal, that's fine. I had a lady once who said, you know, I don't care how my dog can feel what they like as long as they don't show it.
Wow.
That was what she, that's how she viewed stuff. And she said the same about her child. That's how she's bringing up her son.
Wow.
So I think people see it that way.
A lot.
Yeah, but that's not an unusual view in society, sadly. But anyway,
that's really sad, though. I don't like that. That makes me sad. Let's not leave it on a sad note.
Well, no, let's inject some sparkle.
Right, everybody, take a deep breath in. Inhale the air, breathe the bullshit out, and we are good with the world again.
You know what? There's two things that I want to leave us with. One is, when I did my psychology, human psychology degree, one of the lecturers said, one thing to bear in mind is that we're all buggered in our own way. And that's always stuck with me, because we all kind of are. And the second thing that goes with that is we're all trying our best, really. Trying our best is important, because we all are. But we can't have that as an excuse for when we have things that we have to grow and learn from.
Mm-hmm.
And that does mean us being a bit humble and a bit, the ability to take stock and think, right, maybe this isn't what I thought it was, especially when we think about those kind of tools and stuff. But
yeah, exactly that. So guys, as always, you can find me, you can now find Dodge on Threads as well, if you are down with the kids and on the Threads, at Canine Hoopers World on the Facebook and the Insta, at Dodge Shepherd on Insta and Threads, and Canine Hoopers World on the TikTok. And as always, until next time, stay safe, be kind, wash your hands thoroughly, keep your dogs on lead around livestock, and don't let them lick toads. Take care, guys. Bye. Guys, I just wanted to ask you a real quick favour. If you could rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, it's going to help other people find me and listen to what I'm doing here at Canine Hoopers World. We're now on all the socials. So we have the Instagram, we have the Facebook, and we are officially on the TikTok at Canine Hoopers World. And remember to check out our website, www.caninehoopersworld.com, where you can find out information on in-person courses, online courses, and if you're doing Hoopers with your dog, you can also join in with our online achievement awards. These are open to any person, any dog, anywhere in the world to come and test your skills and get yourself a cool ribbon.